Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. Alex P. Linder, for those of you keeping track. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Yeah! Today, thanks to all the faulty wiring lately, including my nose and the recording being less than insufficient, I'm going to simply reboot and record shorter periods every time I want to do this. But you know, that's technical stuff that doesn't matter. What does matter is what we're talking about, what we're learning about, what we need to know about. Give the kids the information they need to get through that thing called life. The intelligent among you may recognize the callbacks there to both Prince and Guns N' Roses. We are midships, midstream, in A People That Shall Dwell Alone. Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy by Kevin MacDonald, the famous professor out of Southern California in the California state system, perhaps now retired, I think. Anyway, so we're going to do, let's try about 113 to 127 today, and we're talking about, we're in the middle of the chapter 4, Genetic and Cultural Segregation of Jews and Gentiles. So that's what we're going to deal with. We'll just do a little briefer segments, so maybe get the recording to work a little better. And there's very disheartening, I might say in my defense, to record like an hour and a half and you think it's really good stuff, it sounds good, you gave some good commentary, and then it didn't record right. So rather than have me crying into my pillow, we're just going to do a shorter segment after rebooting so that nothing else is open and get it right. And now, with 2 minutes of prefatory garbage behind us, we begin. Judaism as a national / ethnic religion in the ancient world. A national ethnic religion, national / ethnic religion. Remember, Hitler said Judaism is a race, not a religion. It's a race pretending to be a religion, or it's a race that worships its own blood, as the Catholics like to say about us racialists, which is certainly true of the Jews and is true of some racialists, but not all. Some white racialists. Begins with an epigraph here in 113. Judaism as a national / ethnic religion in the ancient world. So Judaism is a race cult in the ancient world. In old times, it was a race cult before people knew everything there was to know about science and race. We still don't, but Petronius had also in mind the vast numbers of the Jewish nation, which is not confined, as every other nation is, within the borders of one country assigned for its sole occupation, but occupies almost the whole world. Even in the ancient times, Jews were spread out all over the place. For it is overflowed across every continent and island, so that it scarcely seems to be outnumbered by the native inhabitants. And that's Philo in Legatio, page 214. Now, I should insert here that I'm going to generally not give all the scholarly citations. You can go to the book for that. I think they impede the flow and the understanding, and inhibit the understanding a little bit too much. Now, I'll mention them if he goes to them 50 times, but I'm not going to give every single one. So if you want that, buy the book. But rest assured, MacDonald uses hundreds of sources. There's a very long bibliography. Anyway, so Jews were all over the place in the ancient world, according to Philo. And unlike every other country, they were spread out, and there already was a diaspora, and every other nation was within its borders. So this is an observation from a long time ago. So how do you keep yourself from assimilating into the people you're living among when you're spread out like that? Well, you have to have some kind of a culture, some kind of social controls. You have to have some way of instructing your kids, hey, you're not like those other people that live all around you. You're different. How do they do that? Now, MacDonald, 114. Again, we're only going to go up to about 127 in this section, so we can really focus. Apologists for the position that Judaism aggressively sought and succeeded in obtaining large number of proselytes. We heard that last time. Jews will sometimes lie that they're open to receiving converts, but in reality, they're not. They take very few, and they're looked down upon. They're at the bottom of the social scale, the few that they do accept. So they lie because they're trying to fool people. That's why people lie. implicitly downplay the national ethnic character of Judaism in the ancient world. Again, ancient world, Roman times, pre 500 years before Jesus, up to Jesus times, the ancient world. However, there is overwhelming evidence, says McDonald, that in fact, Judaism was considered by both Jews and Gentiles as a national slash ethnic religion, a race cult is the term I would use, throughout the period. In a classic treatment, Moore, 1927-30, states that Judaism developed as a national religion and that even after the dispersion, quote, they felt themselves members of the Jewish nation. So it's a nationality more than a religion. It's something you're a racial member of. To those who have had dispersed, even after many generations in alien culture, quote, Judaism was in reality not so much the religion of the mother country as the religion of the Jewish race. It was a national religion, not in a political, but in a genealogical sense. So great emphasis on genes and on tracking one's ancestors and being part of a line, and that being extremely important, and this being overall blood purity is extremely important to the ancient Jews, as to the modern Jews. Blood purity. So notice they promote blood, one standard for the Jews, another for everybody else. They promote blood purity for themselves. Understand this person. They promote mongrelization for you. Everything they do, really vicious pornography, emasculating white men and encouraging white women to see them as studs and to breed with them. Why would pornography encourage breeding? But if you go on porn sites, they do promote this idea of whites being inseminated by blacks. They're trying to mongrelize and destroy the competition by getting them to breed with violent, stupid, inferior races. Because otherwise, there wouldn't be any reason to inject that political garbage into pornography. Although E. Michael Jones and others would say pornography is inherently political, and they're right in that regard, but super add on top of it a specific bent to that politics beyond general familial destruction, encouraging you to immerse yourself in the destructive element. You see, blood purity is what they want for themselves. And they're against it for you. They want mongrelization and messed up lives for you. So when they talk down racism, they are yet the ultimate racist. And we're talking about the ancient world. They always have been this kind of racist. That's what got them started. That's why they are the one people out of those times to survive. There are no Romans today. There are no Hittites. There are no Assyrians. There are no Phoenicians. There are no Babylonians. But there are Jews. Why? Because they kept their blood purity. They valued themselves. They valued intelligent, responsible, careful breeding. They valued breeding for intelligence. They're not Christians. They value intelligence. They know what's good in this world. They know what's valuable. And it's not a bunch of garbage and lies about how one world and brotherhood and kumbaya and all that. Community of the Spirit. It's not that that's valuable. It's the blood purity. Christianity is the body of Jesus is what matters. A spiritual body versus a race cult. A racial group that is proud of itself and values itself and protects itself, prolongs, extends, and empowers itself by the culture that it creates in defense of its own kind and its own blood. Judaism really is hominids acting according to the natural principle that one species drives out another, or one subspecies fight until one vanquishes the other. Their philosophy is 100% in line with that. Now again, McDonald is not a polemicist. He can't be a polemicist and an academic at the same time. But you can get to these points I'm making from this text, which is actually a little dry and boring. Because he's just simply piling up facts, and he's proving his case logically and keeping emotion for the best part out of it until you get to the culture of critique and some of the later writing when he's, you know, more summing it up and it's a little more appropriate. But even there, he's still very careful to be controlled in it, because otherwise he would undermine himself and make it easy for them to discredit him. But people like me who are kind of in between, kind of, you know, in between the PhDs who come up with some of the proven facts, and to people who might not understand, and putting it into popular terms, turning it into a rhetorical argument. I'm a rhetorician, a polemicist. So turn it into arguments that can be used that actually work and inflame people to get you to understand these people value themselves and their race and protect their kind. We don't. We're fobbed off in this absurdity about people coming back from the dead called Jesus himself, you know, supposedly a Jew. Instead of valuing our own race, we value a Semitic superhero. That's insane. And it's led us downhill while they've been led uphill by their belief in their own genes and their own value and protecting themselves, developing a culture and social controls to protect and value themselves. So we need something that protects and values our genes. And that's the concept of Team White. That's what the Nazis were doing. It wasn't just some bizarre German phenomenon. It was for all Europeans who wanted to get rid of this horrible Bolshevism so that whites could live the way they want to live. Now, let's return to the text. Even after many generations in alien cultures, Judaism was in reality not so much the religion of the mother country as the religion of the Jewish race. Jewish race. Jewish race. It was a national religion, not in a political sense, but in a genealogical sense. Again, genealogy, begat, 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 begat. Probably the commonest word in the Old Testament is begat. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you there's some focus and interest in genealogy. What is genealogy but racial lines, blood purity? As a result, conversion, quote, was not entrance into a religious community. It was naturalization in the Jewish nation. That is, since the idea of nationality was racial rather than Jewish race, and despite instances of conversion, quote, the Jews were, in their own mind, and in the minds of their Gentiles surrounding, and before the Roman law, not adherents of a particular religion. So the Roman law and Gentiles see them, and the Roman law treats them as alien nationals. Or as nationals in their own right, nationals who belong to their own nation, which is different from Rome, or subject to Rome if they are within the Roman Empire. Not adherents of a peculiar religion, but members of a nation who carried with them from the land of their origin into every quarter where they established themselves, their national religion and their national customs. So essentially they're resident aliens within the Roman Empire. And there's a footnote there. I won't even read the footnote numbers. He's got a lot of footnotes, right? We'll read the footnotes when we get to the end of the end notes when we get to the end of the chapter, which we won't in this segment. But know that he's loaded with heavily studded with academic citations and end notes. McDonald's works are. But for the flow, we're trying to get the basic understanding here. If you want more, you get the book and research it out further. Emphasizing the national character of ancient Judaism, both the Persian and the Roman empires recognized the offices of exilarch, E-X-I-L-A-R-C-H, you can get from the word what it means, like the exiled king, which traced its descent in an unbroken line from King Jehoiachin in the Babylonian exile, and patriarch Nasi, N-A-S-I, as symbols of former Jewish authority or sovereignty. Both of these offices, the exilarch and the Nazi, or patriarch, both of these offices had great wealth and prestige, as well as authority and influence over Jews in the diaspora throughout the ancient period. Moore points out that within Roman law, the privileges granted to Jews applied only to born Jews, not converts, and the patriarch of the Jewish religion, quote, was treated as the head, not of a religious body, but of the Jewish people, the patriarch with a capital P, at least in part because he exercised power over his people in the same manner as that of a king, including the ability to inflict corporal punishment. That's how much of a real existing nation within a nation they actually were in the ancient world, even. Aviona shows that it was the policy of the Patriarchate, Patriarch with A-T-E on the end, it was the policy of the Patriarchate to gradually restore as much national sovereignty in Palestine as possible. And remember, they're rebelling and fighting the Romans to reestablish their rule there, like they would fight successfully the British around the time of the end of World War II to blowing up the King David Hotel to establish Zionism in the State of Israel formally. Well, they're doing that same kind of garbage when they were in that area of the Roman Empire back then. They're fighting them constantly, trying to reestablish as much national sovereignty in Palestine as possible, including the ability to impose the death penalty. And then already in the 3rd century, Palestine was essentially a state within a state. The relationship with the homeland was also reinforced by pilgrimages, as well as by an obligation to mention the hope of a restored temple in Jerusalem 3 times daily in one's prayers. There were also official contacts between the homeland and the diaspora, particularly via the office of patriarch. Quote, with the authority from the center, the envoys supervised the administration of the communities, inspected the implementation of law-stirred and empire-wide quasi-state, and controlled well-organized legal and tax systems. It was only during this period that the patriarchate was allowed to collapse due to the efforts of the newly powerful Christian church, but even then another political body, the Sanhedrin, continued to function much the same as the patriarchate had. In the 7th century, Jewish rule in Jerusalem was re-established briefly, and it was only after their expulsion by their Persian overlords that realistic hopes for the re-establishment of a Jewish nation disappeared until the present century. Clearly, Judaism had retained its national character in the ancient world, and quite self-consciously so. Many Jews in the period believed in the imminent political restoration of Israel as prophesied in the Bible, and even in periods of relative calm, after the suppression of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, there were persistent attempts by zealots to restore complete national sovereignty in Palestine. Even the moderates had a highly developed sense of national allegiance. These beliefs were reflected in a strong national sense of messianism, which persisted among Jews long after the ancient period, where Blavatsky notes that, quote, Jewish messianism, for the greater part of its history, retained its national, social, and historical basis, whatever the universalist cosmic or inner and spiritual meanings accompanying it. So, that is, they always wanted, that's part of the reason they supposedly rejected Jesus. They didn't want a spiritual leader or a spiritual king or a spiritual guide. They wanted an overt, powerful, all-crushing, Rome-destroying military leader to reclaim their national sovereignty. That's the Messiah they wanted. Messiah is the belief someone's going to come and save them. That's what messianism is. One may perhaps speak of a spiritual deepening of the messianic idea in the history of Jewish religious thought, but these allegedly more spiritual elements never replaced the concrete historical messianism. They were looking for a real king, a military leader. They merely added to it. Outbreaks of messianism occurred sporadically throughout Jewish history, most notably the fiasco of Sabbatai Zevi in the 17th century. That's true. That's a crazy story that we've read about in E. Michael Jones, and we have in our earlier audiobooks, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Libido Dominandi. I'm pretty sure it's in Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Sabbatai Zevi is one of their false messiahs. And always with the idea that the political restoration of Israel was at hand. Moreover, it was not uncommon for Jews throughout the centuries to settle in the Holy Land, and where Blavatsky states that these movements were often inspired by messianism. So, Zionism may have been the creature of the late 19th century, but this idea of them going back there had always been around. As discussed below, this self-conscious conceptualization of Judaism as a national/ethnic religion persisted until the 19th century Reform movement. Meyer notes that the rejection of the Jewish doctrine of the Messianic return to Zion by the Reform movement, quote, cast doubt on a central principle of Jewish faith firmly grounded in all layers of Jewish tradition. So in the light of the Enlightenment and Napoleon granting Jews citizenship and letting them out of the ghettos they kind of liked being in, you had the rise of the Reform movement that was sort of tended a little bit towards assimilation, or at least in a sense, well, if we can be citizens of these, in full equality of these white European states, then we don't need Zion so much, I think is what was going on there. But it did, as he says, cast doubt on a central principle of Jewish faith firmly grounded in all layers of Jewish tradition, that they would have their national state reestablished in the Holy Land or in Palestine. To deny hope of Israel's reconstitution as a nation on its own soil and the rebuilding of the temple, remember, originally they couldn't do certain acts without that temple, and the temple was destroyed twice, and supposedly, according to Jones, they tried to rebuild it, and there was all kinds of fires, and God prevented them from rebuilding it when it was destroyed for the second time in 70 AD. To deny hope of Israel's reconstitution as a nation on its own soil and the rebuilding of the temple, it was felt, amounted to a denial of Judaism itself. Why, you're rejecting the very basis and tenets of our religion when you say that we shouldn't have a new Israel refounded. However, this rejection of nationalism as the basis of Judaism was relatively short-lived, even within the Reform movement, since Reform Jews eventually embraced Zionism and a resurgence of Jewish tradition, and Orthodox Jews never abandoned the old conceptualization of Judaism. Moreover, as Werblowski notes, Zionism is the most recent manifestation of the Messianic nationalist ideology of Judaism. So, whether the thing was called Zionism or not, Zionism is just a new name for an old thing, or a thing that always existed in some form, weaker or stronger, throughout the entire 2,000 years before Israel was established. And that ends that subsection, but next one. Consanguinity, that's same blood, endogamy, marrying within the community, and the hierarchy of racial purity among Jews in the post-biblical period. So, blood purity focused. Some epigraphs here, pretty long. For our forefathers made provision that the stock of the priests should continue unmixed. Remember, Judaism comes out of these priests, first and foremost, who are trying to defend and provide for themselves and lead the people. This priestly class comes up with all their rules. Our forefathers made provision that the stock of the priests should continue unmixed and pure, for he who is partaker of the priesthood must propagate of a wife of the same nation, and take his wife's genealogy from the ancient tables, and procure many witnesses to it, and this is our practice, not only in Judea, but wheresoever any body of men of our nation do live, and even there, an exact catalogue of our priests' marriages is kept. But if any war falls out, those priests that survive them compose new tables of genealogy out of the old records and examine the circumstances of the women that remain, for still they do not admit of those that have been captives, as suspecting that they had conversation with some foreigners. We have the names of our high priest from father to son set down in our records for the interval of 2,000 years. That's Flavius Josephus against Appian, A-P-I-O-N. 1:30-36. So they're saying that, look, above all, the priests are the most racially pure among Judaism and must be kept that way, and we've kept them pure for 2,000 years. We keep all of our records. They're very detailed and careful. This is what matters to us, racial purity, above all. And Judaism is you move up or down the scale of racial purity. So converts would be at the very lowest end of the scale, and priests would be at the very highest end, and you can only really intermarry. It's a sort of a caste system almost within Judaism, or at least a class system within it, that you can't easily move up at all. And this is how they protect their blood purity. Next epigraph, also from Flavius Josephus, Vita 1. While different races base their claims to nobility on various grounds, with us, a connection with the priesthood is the hallmark of an illustrious line. Blood purity is the key to being the Jew priest, or being respected among the Jews. And a third, not from Flavius Josephus, up to the present, it has not been sufficiently recognized that, from a social point of view, the whole community of Judaism at the time of Jesus was dominated by the fundamental idea of the maintenance of racial purity. The whole community of Judaism was dominated by the fundamental idea of maintaining racial purity at the time of Jesus. Racial purity at the time of Jesus was what mattered to the Jews. Not only did the priests, as the consecrated leaders of the people, watch anxiously over the legitimacy of priestly families and weed out all priestly descendants born of an illegitimate union, but the entire population itself, in the theory and practice of religious legislation at the time of Jesus, was classified according to purity of descent. The entire population was essentially blood value. What's your racial purity value? What's your racial purity index? The entire population was looked at that way. Classified according to purity of descent. The entire population. All families in which some racial impurity could be established were excluded in 270. So the pure seed of the community would be the priestly class. So you can still be a Jew, but if you're racially impure, you had some impure, you weren't as good as the top, well, you couldn't be part of the priestly clan, the Kohenim and the other ones. There's two or three names that, like Kohen, that are in that class. The importance of consanguinity in the post-biblical period is the first subtitle. Those were epigraphs. And this, we're on 118. We're only going up to 127 today. As indicated in chapters 3 and 8, the Jewish tendency toward consanguinity in marriage, the people sharing the same blood, con, with blood, right? If you go back to the roots of sanguine, cheerful, or red, or bloody. The Jewish tendency toward consanguinity in marriage, again, think uncle and niece, it was typically what they did, is of considerable theoretical importance, says MacDonald. The tendency toward consanguinity in marriage is big for theory. During the Second Commonwealth, the Pharisees attached special spiritual significance to marriages with nieces. Uncle-niece marriage. Dad, two boys grow up, two brothers, and one marries the sister, or one marries the daughter of the other, and that was big among Jews. Uncle-niece marriage was common during the Second Commonwealth. He cites Epstein, Mitterauer, and Jeremias. While marriage to nieces was essentially tolerated by the Levitical rules, later it came to be viewed as desirable by the more devout, including priestly families whose concern with purity of blood and genealogy is a recurrent theme of this volume. Priestly families whose concern with purity of blood and genealogy is a recurrent theme. Uncle-niece marriage was idealized in the Talmud. Quote, one who married his sister's daughter, on him, the Bible says, they thou will call and God will answer. The Shulhan Aruch, S-H-U-L-H-A-N-A-R-U-K-H, two words, Shulhan Aruch, an authoritative legal compilation dating from the 16th century, also idealized uncle-niece marriage. So again, keep that in mind. Uncle-niece marriage was idealized in the Talmud. marrying the daughter of your siblings, whether man or woman. Idealized in the Talmud. It's an ideal that you would marry your siblings' kids. Think about that from the white point of view. So these are the people who are mocking whites for being inbred, and their Talmud idealizes inbreeding. Idealizes it. Goitein, G-O-I-T-E-I-N, Goitein notes that despite its legitimacy and the elevated status of one's sister's children at the time, there were relatively few uncle-niece marriages recorded in the Geniza, or Geniza, G-E-N-I-Z-A, documents from the medieval Islamic period, quite possibly because of the influence of the Karaite sect, K-A-R-A-I-T-E, during this period. However, common. Grossman notes a clear trend toward consanguinity among the distinguished families of sages in Spain and Germany in the Middle Ages. I-A-J-I-A-N, Boyajian, finds frequent consanguineous marriages, including marriage between uncles and nieces, as well as between first cousins, in the Sephardic international trading networks. So the Sephardics, the minority of Jews, the 10% of Jews at this point, also do the uncle-niece thing and the first-cousin thing. So Jews are very big on niece, uncle, and first-cousin marriages, whether Sephardic or Ashkenazic. And that, so he says he found a lot of that in the Sephardic international trading networks in the 16th to 18th centuries. Now think about Disraeli, a Sephardic Jew, first Jew to become Prime Minister of England, and he wrote Siddhartha and Coningsby, which are two novels in which he says blood is the secret to all history. Purity of the blood is what elevates his race above the other races, that they keep their purity of blood. So that's in line what he's saying. He also says the world is governed by behind the scenes by people in a way that is very different from what the public thinks, because it's a bunch of blood purity focused Jews who are actually running the world, and the idiot stupid goyim who don't value their blood don't realize that. So these Jews see themselves as sharper and smarter than the rest of us. Do they have grounds for that? If they among your kind. Indeed, Beinart notes that one of the criticisms, and remember, Peter Beinart is a left-wing Jew in the U.S., a journalist now, who responded to Charlottesville by saying, yeah, we went by you a long time ago. They already replaced us in the higher institutions like Harvard, where they're overrepresented by a factor of 1,000. So again, here's another Jew named Beinart who's a scholar writing about this and blood purity. It's the key to Jews' success and keeping themselves together for millennia, even when living in hostile, strange, foreign lands, where it would have been more natural actually to assimilate because of the advantages. A people that doesn't value its own blood will disappear because it will simply assimilate into whatever is around it. Beinart notes that one of the criticisms of the new Christians, those are the Jew converts, whether real or fake, by the old Christians during the period of the Inquisition was that they continued to intermarry and did so within the degrees of relatedness prohibited by the church. So the church is actually, it's taking in these Jew converts, but dripping water on them doesn't change. They're doing it for social reasons and to avoid being, you know, imprisoned or attacked, whatever, by the white population. But they're still keeping up what really matters, their blood purity, by marrying each other, even in ways that are forbidden by the church. So it's like the church is forbidding us from doing what actually works to preserve our blood purity from the Jew point of view. So Jews laugh at our supposed inbreeding while they actually practice it and believe in it. In the United States, Jews have sometimes been exempted from laws prohibiting uncle-niece marriages and from laws prohibiting first-cousin marriage. Berman shows that cousin marriage was common among wealthy Jewish families in England beginning in the 18th century. Kaplan shows that Jews in Germany between 1870 and 1930 were far more likely to engage in consanguineous marriage than Gentiles, especially in the more traditional small towns and rural areas. They wouldn't even think of marrying the German farmer and peasants. Generally, however, in recent times, the rate of consanguineous marriages, including uncle-niece marriages, has been declining among all Jewish groups, especially Ashkenazi Jews, although such marriages are not uncommon among some Oriental and Sephardic groups. So they are starting to breed out some, MacDonald is saying, in modern times. In one group of Oriental Jews, the Habanites, H-A-B-B-A-N, the rate of first-cousin marriages in modern times was 56%. That's some incredible inbreeding. The maintenance of racial purity in the post-biblical period. During the Restoration following the Babylonian exile, Ezra's racial doctrine legally prohibited any marriage with individuals with a taint of foreign blood, and there was an increased concern for tracing genealogies and separating the community into groups that varied in the purity of their blood. The result, as we have seen in Chapter 3, was that the community was divided into a hierarchy of racial purity. So Jews loved to mock any white concern with racial purity, but they themselves are divided into a hierarchy of racial purity, with obviously their priestly class at the top. Flipping to page 120, and we're just going to the top of 127 today. While racialist ideology declined after Ezra's restoration, racial exclusivity continued in practice. Quote, purity of stock continued as a token of aristocracy. Family records were guarded jealously, and the separation of classes by blood taint, as established by Ezra, remained in effect for centuries after. Direct quote from Epstein. Even beyond the end of the Second Commonwealth, intermarriage of those known to have foreign blood with those of doubtful status would not occur in practice until all memory and records of the foreign taint were lost, and such persons could never intermarry with those whose genealogies were known, including especially the priests and the Meyuhasim, Meyuhasim, Hasim, those able to marry into priestly families who were at the top of the hierarchy of purity of blood. They could never intermarry with them. The priesthood itself was, quote, a closed circle, which was not easily penetrated except by a few Israelitish families of exceptional distinction. Legitimacy within the priesthood was established by producing the appropriate genealogies and, indeed, the common conceptualization of Jews in the ancient world, as seen by the epigraph from Josephus quoted at the beginning of this section, was that priests could be traced directly back to Aaron, the brother of Moses. Again, hence all the begats in the Bible, the obsession and the importance of maintaining accurate genealogies attesting to and protecting racial purity. That's what Jews actually believed. The people who invented the anti-white smear racism actually believe completely in racism, to use their term, demonize something that they actually believe is the ultimate good thing. The world moves by irony. The world moves by deceit and deception. Stern, 1976, comments on the high level of consanguinity of the priests during the Second Temple period and notes the preponderance of these families in the Jewish aristocracy of the period. As Mitterauer notes, concerns for consanguinity and for racial purity dovetailed because by choosing a close relative for marriage, one could be more sure about his/her purity of descent. other families that became prominent, such as the Tobiads and the Hillels, managed to marry into priestly families. The priestly families. Jeremiah's insurer provide detailed accounts of Jewish practices related to racial purity in the ancient world. Genealogical examinations extending back at least four generations of mothers on each side, five if the prospective bride was a Levite or Israelite, were very carefully performed. Moreover, ordinary Israelites also knew the last few generations of their ancestors and which of the 12 tribes they belonged to. This was extremely important because only families of pure race were considered to make up the, quote, true Israel. Some lay people had genealogies that, like those of the priests, extended back to the time of King David. There is some suggestion that the priestly genealogies, along with the genealogies of the lay families who had married into the priestly class, were stored in an official archive at the temple, which was destroyed early in the Common Era by King Herod out of jealousy because of his own lack of lineage. Moreover, establishing one's genealogy was the ticket to success in the society and inclusion among the elect in the messianic world to come. It was the height of respectability to be able to say that one came from a family that could marry their daughters to priests or have sons who could serve in the temple. All important honors and positions of public trust were dependent on establishing one's genealogy. Christ, to join Hitler's SS, you had to prove your lineage back 300 years, that you had no Jews involved in it. So they were even, the Jews were themselves, and that's why the Judaism was the mirror to it was Nazism, because they're trying to protect our blood against these people who are trying to destroy it, while protecting their own. Valuing genealogy as part of protecting blood, obviously. Emphasizing the religious nature of obligation to retain genetic purity, Jeremias notes that, quote, "Here we have the most profound reason for the behavior of these pure Israelite families, why they watch so carefully over the maintenance of racial purity and examine sons and daughters-in-law before marriage. For on this question of racial purity hung not only the social position of their descendants, but indeed their final assurance of salvation, their share in the future redemption of Israel." The doctrine that only pure Israelites would share in the redemption brought about by the Messiah resulted in the belief that salvation itself depended on purity of blood. This is how seriously they take race. Think about all the garbage they put out to us, and yet they believe the exact opposite for themselves. And they not only believe it, they practice it. And they not only practice it, they practice it for thousands of years. That's how seriously they take race, racialism. That's how serious Jewish nationalists are. We white nationalists have to be serious about our cause at least as strongly as they are in order to defeat them trying to destroy us. Given the hierarchy of racial purity, it is not surprising that individuals at the lower levels of racial purity would not abandon its concern with genealogy when legal barriers to marriage were lessened. Jeremias emphasizes that the priestly class adopted, quote, "an inexorably rigorous stand," unquote, on issues related to marriage and racial purity, far more restrictive than that prescribed by the scribes. Even though it was legally possible for a priest to marry any Israelite of legitimate descent, in fact, high priests almost invariably married members of other priestly families. So the priests are only marrying among themselves, marrying off their kids to each other, or even their own family. This continuing concern with genealogy, despite the lack of legal restrictions, was typical of the community as a whole, not only priestly families. Epstein notes that Israelites of distinction thought it socially improper to marry a half-Jew, despite the leniency of the halakha. In the diaspora, it was common for priestly genealogies to be publicly displayed well into the medieval period, and genealogies continued to be of great importance among the scholars and other elite Jewish families in 12th century Babylon. Descent in these families was traced back to the original tribes of Israel. Similarly, Goetain describes the reading of genealogies at funerals in the medieval Islamic period, in which ancestors were commonly traced back 10 generations or more. Levite families, suggesting a continuing concern with maintaining the purity of lines of descent over a period of at least 1,000 years. Goetain notes that in the 20th century, even common Jewish emigrants from Yemen knew their ancestors for 6 or more generations, and suggests that this represents a continuity with previous practices. A continuing concern with genealogies and purity of blood can also be seen by considering with writings of Maimonides in the 12th century. That's a misprint typo in this. There's actually a fair number of not so much typos as like two words where one of them wasn't deleted and should have been. So probably there they have the word with when they should have the. So Maimonides in the 12th century, we're looking at the ancient world, but we're getting starting to get out of that, was also concerned with genealogy and purity of blood. Johnson notes that Maimonides, and he's one of the biggest names in Jewish history, Maimonides, Heinrich Gretz, the biggest historical historian among the Jews. But again, you have to, when you call someone a Jewish historian, you have to put an asterisk by it, because history, fiction, lies, propaganda, the only thing that dominates what Jews write is what is good for Jews. So they will make up a lie. They do not feel, some individuals might, but generally as a race, they do not feel a compunction to try to get and print the truth. They feel a compunction to do what is good for Jews. And it's good for Jews to lie most of the time due to their behavior in relation to others. Maimonides himself could list 6 generations of his father's ancestors and 14 generations for his father-in-law's family through the illustrious female side. He also notes that most Jews could trace their lineage through at least 7 generations, reflecting the supreme importance of scholarly ability within the Jewish community and the high level of reproductive success of scholars. See Chapter 7. The genealogy typically began with the name of a well-known scholar. Maimonides' concern with genealogy is also apparent in his codification of Jewish law in the 12th century. Priests were liable to be flogged for any intercourse with a heathen woman. A priest caught in the act of intercourse with a heathen woman was liable to be put to death. Quote, should zealots fall upon him and slay him, they are worthy of commendation for their zeal. A child born from such a union was not admitted to the fold of Israel, and, indeed, the heathen woman, quote, is liable to be put to death because an offense has been committed by an Israelite through her, just as in the case of an animal. At this point, Maimonides relies on Numbers 31:16-17, in which Moses commands the killing of the non-virgin Midianite woman captured in the war of the conquest of Canaan. Maimonides notes that the rules of the Torah and the sages are fairly lenient regarding intercourse with a slave woman. He states, however, quote, nevertheless, let not this transgression be esteemed lightly in your eyes, just because the Torah does not prescribe a flogging, for this also causes a man's son to depart from following after the Lord, since the bondswoman's son, that's a slave son, is likewise a slave, and is not of Israel, not a Jew, like us. The offspring of a concubine slash slave is thus not admitted to the community, and indeed, intercourse with such a woman is compared to sodomy, citing Deuteronomy 23:18. Conversion of the bondswoman removes these difficulties, but Maimonides reiterates the general distrust of proselytes typical of the ancient world, citing the Talmudic dictum that, quote, proselytes are as hard to bear for Israel as a scab upon the skin. Since the majority of them become proselytes for ulterior motives and subsequently lead Israel astray, And once they become proselytes, it is a difficult matter to separate from them. So they don't want converts, and they don't seek them. Though occasionally they might take one here or there. The latter comment indicates that the community would attempt to remain separate from proselytes. The Maimonidean Code reiterates the discriminatory regulations on the marriage of proselytes. Interestingly, the descendants of the proselyte continue to be impaired until all memory is lost of a person's impaired origins. Thus, the offspring of two proselytes, but not the offspring of a proselyte and an Israelite, is permitted to marry a bastard, quote, and so on until his proselyte descent sinks into oblivion, and the fact that he is a descendant of proselytes is no longer known. After that, he is forbidden to marry a bastard. Presumably, the requisite length of time would at least be 7 generations, since it was common to know one's genealogy at least to this extent. Maimonides describes rules for ascertaining the purity of descent of a family. If 2 witnesses testify that a bastard, an unfit prince, or an unfit priest, or a slave is in the family's ancestry, a bastard, an unfit priest, or a slave, people are advised not to marry into that family until there is an investigation of the 8 maternal relatives on each side, including great-great-grandmothers. If the family is Levitical or Israelite, the investigation is to proceed to the great-great-great-grandmother level, because there it is said there is said to be a greater danger of pollution in non-priestly families. Interestingly, despite the concentration on investigating female relatives to assure family purity, the goal is to maintain the purity of the male line, Ezra's, quote, holy seed. Females can marry men of invalid descent, but not the reverse. And in a previous passage, Maimonides notes that in intermarriages among priests, Levites, and Israelites, the child retains the status of the father, quote, as it is said, and they declared their pedigrees after their families by their fathers' houses. Maimonides then presents a discussion of the necessity of proving genealogy for the priests in his day. Pedigree must be traced to a priest who ministered at the altar in the temple or was a member of the Sanhedrin prior to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Quote, since only priests, Levites, and Israelites of proven genealogy were appointed to the Sanhedrin. Priests of proven genealogy must produce witnesses that their sons are indeed their sons, and that the women they marry are of valid descent. There is a long section on determining whose testimony is to be believed, on preventing fraud, and on ensuring that the father was a priest by classifying as doubtful priests those children born to a woman who remarries within 3 months of the birth of a child. If a child is born out of wedlock, he cannot be a priest, quote, as it is said, and it shall be to him and to his seed after him the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, so long as his seed traces its proven genealogy from him with assurance. All of these concerns indicate that in the 12th century, genealogy, and especially the genealogy of the priestly group, was still of great concern. Moreover, being of priestly descent still resulted in considerable social respect. Maimonides describes a child recounting his immersion and eating of the priestly heave offering, or that may be a misprint, who states that his companions, quote, kept their distance from me and called me Yohanan, the eater of dough offering. The elevated status of individuals from the tribes of the Levites and the priests, the Kohanim, K-O-H-A-N-I-M, continued as an element of synagogue service into modern times and persist among Orthodox Jews and Haredim. So if you're from the Levites or the Kohanim, you're higher status. The first 2 men to read from the Torah at the traditional Ashkenazi synagogue service were required to be from the tribes of the Levites and the Kohanim, the priestly class. The rules requiring Kohanim to refrain from marrying widows or divorced women were also observed, as was the rule that the Kohanim must have no contact with the dead. The birth of one's firstborn son was the occasion for a contribution to a member of the Kohanim, a practice that dates back to the idea that the firstborn son was obligated to serve in the temple unless redeemed by a payment to the priesthood. Genealogy was also of great importance in the traditional Jewish shtetl communities of Eastern Europe. There was a strong concern for yichus, defined as referring to the purity of one's lineage, Y-I-K-H-U-S, yichus, but also including the scholarly credentials and economic success of one's ancestry. Meyer notes that yichus is a sort of credit rating. One's rating is presumed to be known until proven otherwise, but proof of one sort or another must be furnished in the form of recognizable credentials, a bank account, a genealogy, etc. In the Eastern European shtetl, the yichus of every member is generally known down to the last detail, and to recite one's yichus to a new acquaintance is an integral part of an introduction. Just how weird and different these people are from us. Moreover, the family with yichus will strive to maintain it, to keep its purity unsullied, and if possible to augment it. Many a girl has been forced to renounce. There is a powerful continuing concern with yichus among groups of Orthodox Jews in contemporary America and Israel. Kamen, K-A-M-E-N, describes one such community of Hasidic Jews in 20th century America, the Tzadzikim, T-Z-A-D-D-I-K-I-M, righteous men, the Tzadzikim, the Tzadikim, righteous men who lead the community, are regarded as having, quote, holy seed, and inherit their positions, what Kamen terms hereditary saintliness. Hasidic rebbes typically trace their genealogy to the founder of Hasidim, Baal Shem Tov, B-A-A-L-S-H-E-M-T-O-V, or one of his disciples. Meyer describes the followers of one Eastern European rebbe who reestablished his lineage in 1963 by locating his grandson. Clearly, genetic Jews are absolutely about racial purity, and if they lose that focus, they will disappear as a group, just as every other group from the time they were established and the people they lived among did disappear, in fact. So you guard your blood purity or you ain't got nothing. Keep that in mind when they mock you for being a racist, when they mock you for concern with blood purity, when they mock you for concern with genes, for concern with IQ, for concern with genealogy, for concern with families and traditions and customs. Everything they mock among you, they practice to the nth degree among themselves because they know the value. They know the value. So really what they believe white nationalism is extremely important, extremely valuable, and extremely good. The Jews know that Team White is an absolutely wonderful, necessary, sine qua non, absolutely essential thing for whites, even if they only want to continue to exist. Because if they don't value themselves, they will yield to Jewish lies, they will yield to Jewish mal-encouragements, let us coin a term, and they will disappear as a race, and that's exactly what the Jews want. So you see what they say because it's not avoidable being ubiquitous, the telepoison and in the internet even, but when you watch what they do and when you hear about their history from us here at the Learning College, you see the reality is that they are the ultimate racists, the ultimate racialist, and they want us to be exactly the opposite, right? Thanks for being with me today. I've been Alex Linder, reading to you out of Kevin MacDonald's A People That Shall Dwell Alone. And this and everything that we would do as part of our Learning College is recorded at vnnforum.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you again real soon.